you can interact with us via email, emsgarage@gmail.com, or you can call us at 206-984-1622. That's 206-984-1622. The EMS Garage.
Okay, I got DC on the phone. They want to know if you can handle that call as well. Just confirming you are checking the patient.
Salmon 22 is on scene.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the EMS Garage. It's your weekly dose of EMS garageness, I guess. We're talking about stories and news interest items in the world of EMS and all over. And really talking about the world of EMS because tonight I have Tom Reynolds from the UK. Hello, sir.
Good morning.
Good morning for you.
Is and for once I can say it's sunny England, because it is actually, well, I mean, it's not sunny now because it's dark, but it has been sunny.
Has it been warm?
That's really important for us. Yeah, it's been like 23 Celsius, which is like sweltering for us. Very unusual.
That's warm. Very nice. That's in the 70s there, right? 70s, 80s, somewhere there.
I've got a lovely tan on one of my arms from driving the ambulance.
From sticking your arm out the window.
The other arm, not so much.
See, one day you need to...
The UK is a fascinating place when the weather gets warm. I spent 2 years in Scotland when I was a wayward lad, and it was fascinating to see the temperature get to 56 degrees, and people would go down to the shore of the Firth of Clyde, and they'd you know, take off their outer shirt and sit there in their undershirt with their trouser legs rolled up above their knees to take in the rays. It was fascinating. You could tell there's people for whom warm sunny days were a very special thing.
And that mysterious voice is Mr. Skip Kirkwood. Hello.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm good. Hey, Tom, in your country, do you guys have days where you wheel and then the other day you heel? So you need those days where you can trade off and on the other side of the ambulance. I always
We do. But of course, when you're attending, when you're not driving, you spend half the shift in the back with the patient.
Oh, right.
So you know, what we need to do is we need to park up the ambulance at the hospital so that our... off-arm is getting a bit more sun.
Nice. All right. Well, thank you, guys. Thanks for joining me. Mr. Ben Dennering, hello.
Hi, everybody.
How have you been?
Good. Always good.
It's been a while since we had you on.
Yeah. But I've been trying to enjoy the sunny weather up here.
Nice. Yeah, it's just like that in Summit County. When it's not snowing and it's sunny, everybody comes out and it's really happy, even in July.
Man.
I was over there the other day, and I'm like, oh, it's so cold. I went home. It was in the 70s. I was really happy. Oh. And Mr. Buck Ferris, hello.
Hey.
Hey. Ooh, that smooth, silky voice.
It's smooth.
Bucky from Kentucky.
Yeah.
That's right.
Hey, I'm going to give you a 30-second shot. Tell us what you're working on, a new show.
Oh, yeah. No, it's a new show. It's called Copy Code 3. And it premieres on July 13th, and it's a very much an in-depth interview show on topics and various people. And right now we get the promo for our new show up as a 60-second spot over there at copycode3.com. It will look a little bit different than it does now, but there is something there, a place where you can dig around and find stuff. We're proud of it. We're working hard. And I hope that we make all our deadlines by July 13th. So everybody's... Yeah. So I might be calling on some of you guys to help me out with this project and wish me luck.
Well, I'm excited. I can't wait to hear... I heard that promo and I love it. So it's very... Now, is it copy code spelled out 3 or is it copy code in the number 3?
Actually, it's... Well, right now it's spelled out, but I've got both domains. It'd be... pretty quick, you'll be able to put it in any old way and get there.
Oh, very cool. Okay. Well, I'm typing it in the show notes now, so I want to make sure I get it in right.
Oh,
so
spell it out right now, then.
Okay. Yeah, very cool. Very nice. Well, thank you guys for joining us. I'm Chris Montero. I'm your host. Host extraordinaire, I guess, of all these podcasts that we do. And tonight we wanted to talk about a couple news stories that are pretty newsworthy. It seems like it's MCI season for some reason. I don't really know why that happens, but occasionally we get these stints of MCI. And for the people in the rest of the world, because Tom was like, what's an MCI? It's a mass casualty incident. Or for you, Tom, what was that you called it? A major?
Major incident.
Ah, okay. All right. So a major incident. And
I thought it was a cluster.
Well, that's the other name.
It is also.
Oh, okay.
Oh, yeah. It's a code brown to the biggest extent you could ever imagine. And Skip, you've actually been a part of one really recently, and maybe even talk. We should. I don't want to dissect and analyze the one in DC because not a lot's come out about it yet. But it seems like they did a really nice job. For what they really, it sounded like a pretty nasty scene. So, Skip, give us a quick history of what happened on yours and how many patients and what went well, what didn't go well, and you said you've been dealing with a lot of debriefings lately.
Oh, we've been debriefed to death. Last Tuesday, the only factory in the world that makes Slim Jims, the ConAgra food processing plant in Garner, Oregon, was undergoing some repairs during the normal course of business. And according to the investigators, some natural gas was purged into a room that also performed electrical switching functions. Shortly after the gas entered, a switch closed and sparked and blew up. About a 20,000 square foot area of the building, which was, appeared to be concrete tilt up construction, with a rubber membrane roof, about 20,000 square feet of that collapsed. There were, of course, immediate panic ensued. There were about, just less than 300 people on site. And of course the calls began to the 911 center. I made a tactical mistake for a senior chief officer, which was showing up way too soon. and it was kind of a once in a career kind of thing, because the people were coming out of the building and coming right at us as we foolishly drove right up into the middle of the scene, not knowing that that's what we were doing. People were still on fire. People had, their shirts burned off and their upper bodies, second degree burns, a few of those. There were, a total of 38 patients transported. 22 in the first wave of red and yellow tag patients, including I think 5 burn patients that went to the University of North Carolina Burn Center in Chapel Hill. That 22 were all transported off the scene in 50 minutes. There was then a period of time where the factory folks really did a marvelous job of accounting for their people. They got on the phone to their headquarters in Chicago. All their employees had swiped in with a time card during the day, so they were immediately able to get an accountability list by work center. They counted noses, and the town of Garner, one of our constituent municipalities, evacuated their senior their community center. Sent buses. We sent some transit buses to pick up the remaining 225 or 30 of folks and take them over there to further account for them and enable them to be reunited with their families and what have you. They couldn't get in their cars and leave because many of the cars were crushed under parts of the building that had fallen. And if you can imagine, those of you who have seen the pictures of the Murrah building in Oklahoma City, the front of the building looked like a two-story version of that, with the front wall blown out and the interior of the building visible. During the time when we were sort of rounding up and arranging transport for what we thought were the uninjured, another 18 or so of what I will call worried, uninjured, green-tagged folks decided they wanted to be checked out by a physician for one reason or another. They were distributed amongst local hospitals. And after a really crazy hour of mass casualty management, our role changed into one of incident support, because now the incident turned into a fire suppression and urban search and rescue scene, which it remained for about 20 hours. Then it turned into a criminal investigation scene for about another 24 hours. And then it became the last group to actually own the scene were the Chemical Safety Board and the Occupational Safety and Health folk who were doing their investigation. So we had a very frantic couple of hours up front, and then we did scene safety and responder rehabilitation for the next couple of days.
Very cool. And all total, how many patients?
Well, there was 22 first, and then there was just shy of 40 were transported by ambulance. And then there was another, this other contingent of slightly over 200 who were, I don't know what to call them. They're not, they weren't green tags. They were no tags. They were, survivors who had been evacuated from the building, I guess you'd call them.
People that were there, but didn't really necessarily need anything.
You don't have to go home, but you can't stay here.
Well, didn't get hurt, but now keep in mind, this was our first little cluster of very hot, humid days of the North Carolina summer.
Wow.
So it was 94 degrees and 90% humidity.
Oh, yeah.
And there was one road going past the scene, no other ingress and egress, and a whole bunch of diesel trucks running.
Oh, yeah.
Along with this, further complicating this, this is a, you know, I say they made Slim Jims. It's the only factory in the world that makes Slim Jims.
Oh, wait. Now I'm getting the full implication of this. You mean I can't get a Slim Jim for a while?
There's going to be a worldwide shortage of Slim Jims.
Oh.
For those who may not be familiar, that's a chewable meat product that certain species of Americans enjoy.
I got a technical question.
Yes.
Did you transfer all those first 22 to the same hospital?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. All right. It sounded like you did when you were telling the story.
No. The first people off the scene, the red tags, were burned people.
All right.
And they went to the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, which is about 25 miles to our west. The second wave of a couple of red tags and some yellow tags were trauma system patients. They went to the level one trauma center at Wake Med, and the rest of the patients were staggered amongst our remaining acute care hospitals.
Oh, strong work.
Further complicating the scene, when this one of the things they use a lot of at in meat processing is liquid ammonia for refrigeration and other purposes. And very shortly into the incident, the wind started shifting around, and we were all gasping and gagging and at times nearly overcome by ammonia fumes.
Wow.
So we did have to at one point, we kind of wanted to have a triage area, but big trucks kept arriving and parking in the middle of it. But finally, at one point, we had to try and relocate patient care operations much further south of the building, because neither the patients nor us could do much in the way of breathing.
Wow.
But it was a very interesting event. The bullet that we dodged, and the debriefing I was at today, only the EMS people even knew this existed. 40 minutes before this alarm was sounded, we had a motor vehicle versus Amtrak passenger train on the other side of Raleigh,
wow.
Which fortunately didn't result in any patients being transported. But if we would have had to transport, you know, 10 or 15 of those who had been shaken up, we would have been well and truly in trouble.
Wow. Now, have you, any of you, has anybody else been involved in a, not recently, at any time in their career, an MCI event, and would you want to recap it?
Nothing near that.
I had one called once by an over-enthusiastic officer. we were called to a possible incendiary device in a factory, and the factory was evacuated. One brave bomb disposal bloke went in. me and another ambulance were sitting there quite happily, wasting the day away. Officer turns up. Right, I'm calling a major incident. I mean, why? Said, because it might go off. Said, yeah, in which case one person will get burnt. Right, you're on parking duty, he tells me. I think he'd just done a course. Bless him. No, all the other major incidents that I could have gone to, I've actually been drunk in someone's garden whenever they've happened. So I think as part of the government's plan for, major incident planning is to never have me drunk in a garden again.
Oh, really smart. So what about first July 7th, which we're coming on quite soon?
I was just moving into the flat that I'm living in now, and some electricians came in to turn on me electrics, and they said, oh, there's been an explosion in London. So I plugged in the telly, and I see the back of one of my mates going down into one of the tube stations. Thought, ah, okay.
Yeah, that was quite a mass casualty event.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it highlighted a few things. I mean, mainly communications, to be honest. But we was quite lucky because not far from one of the train stations, we had all the trauma doctors in a meeting. And that worked out quite well. And, of course, one of the other bombs went off outside the British Medical Association. Hmm. So you had a fair few doctors there.
Was that the one that was in the bus that was late to get on the train?
Yeah, I see.
Yeah, the story was one of the bombers was on his way to do another bomb in the train, and for some reason he was behind schedule and his bomb went off on a bus.
Wow.
Man. Mm.
Well,
yeah, not good.
Well, I've been involved in a major incident. It was, probably 2000. Well, a major incident, MCI. It was 2001, 2002. My memory escapes me, but all I remember is I was on duty, two ambulances in a very, very rural area, very frontier. Skip, as you would put it, it was very rural. Our nearest primary care hospital of any sort was 85 miles away. So quite rural. Yeah, quite rural.
Aye.
So I had a bus rollover full of kids. It was one of those big commercial buses that you would charter and take somewhere. And there were about 45 kids. Upon the first initial dispatch information, we started 10 units from surrounding counties, which we knew would probably at the least take us 40 minutes to get a couple more ambulances there. And we only had two ambulances on duty. So we start rolling. As we're rolling further and further into this, we hear more and more updates from the scene as we're getting closer. Because we're 20 miles away. We're 20 minutes easy from the scene. So we have plenty of time to do some pre-planning, call some hospitals, find out some stuff. And so we launch five helicopters, which are en route while we're coming. We have 10 ambulances at this point, and we call regional dispatch in Denver for the flight service, and they actually started sending us another 12 ambulances. So at one point in time, we had 22 ambulances heading toward us for all of these patients. And we started a bus service and all of this while we're en route, which was, it was great because I had plenty of time to start thinking about this stuff. And so we get on scene, and sure enough, we had just about 5 really critical patients. The most critical was flown out first, which, looking back on it, you know, he had a fractured liver and a bunch of other things. And there was a doc on scene. He was an ER physician. So he'd already done all of the triage. And he said, these people are sick. These people, you know, could go by ambulance. These people are all walking. And so it made it pretty easy. So all said and done, it took us right under an hour and 30 minutes to get all the patients off the scene. And we had all of the critical patients off the scene in about 45 minutes from time of incident, which is pretty good for the middle of nowhere. And especially when we had to wait for most of the helicopters, which were about 40 minutes away. So they were there, they were loaded, and we got them out of there pretty quickly. So it, from that aspect, it went pretty flawlessly. But the one thing I remember is, and I tell everybody I laugh, I was the second ambulance on scene only because I couldn't pass the first ambulance that was in front of me because I was trying to pass them the entire time. And I remember the weird chaos of the whole thing, and it was a little surreal. And I look back, and there are people, there are just tons of people everywhere, stuff strewn about, and I'm literally walking around. I'm one of 2 medics on the scene, so I'm walking around telling the basics, but monitor these patients as I'm dispensing nebulized treatments out to about 10 people because they all have asthma and they're all up from lower altitude because this occurred right around 10,000 feet. So I'm like, I should be dealing with trauma, and I'm dealing with medical issues too. So that was kind of interesting, but you know, it worked really well, and I would never want to do it again. Yeah, so you know, kind of one of those calls.
I've had the pleasure of playing on a few of them, a couple smaller ones. About a year into this paramedic thing, I got to run on a school bus full of teenagers that rear-ended another school bus full of teenagers. That was pretty exciting. We had a lot of
hyperventilation.
Yeah, there was plenty of drama and a lot of just kids pouring out of buses onto the side of the road. It was more of an organization issue and getting people into, you know, the hurt, not hurt kind of categories than anything else. It was pretty exciting for a while. I think we only transported 14 or 15 patients and only had 1 or 2 reds and a handful of yellows, but it was, one of those that looked worse than it was and ended up being more paperwork than anything else. And another fun one, our stretch of I-70 up here gets pretty icy in the winter, and we get once in a while more than a few cars involved in a pileup. A couple winters ago, got to do a, I think, 80 or 90 car pileup that we had up here.
Oh, those are just my worst nightmare, I've got to tell you.
I hate them.
Other people would have those in Oregon when I was there from time to time in the fog. And, you know, they're hard, incidents are hard enough to manage when you can see from one end of them to the other. But when, the South Division is 2.5 miles from the North Division and there's 80 cars in between, that just makes my hair stand up, I'll tell you.
Yeah, and those are, it's pretty entertaining to just hand a couple guys some things full of triage tags and tell them to start walking.
See you next week.
Yeah.
Now, in Summit County, you guys do something pretty interesting, and I don't know if you still do it. Do you still tag the antennas based upon, with the different colored flagging tape, based upon what the color of the patient is inside the vehicle?
Yeah, I think the spirit of the policy is we're ideally tagging it for the color of the worst condition patient in the vehicle. So we have some order to go on from there. Cause I mean, when it's the highway in the middle of winter, there's not a lot of sheltering options for treatment areas and things like that. And that gives us a good place to get started.
So, I tell you, that was brilliant. That was really very cool. When the first time I saw that almost 10 years ago now, when I saw that, I'm like, well, that just makes so much sense.
Just to get the other tape. the other cool thing is, I think, for dealing with bystanders in those situations, because bystanders don't have a lot of places to go, and we've got extra flagging in our bags that have one for plain old bystanders and one for bystanders who are, say, they have medical training. So,
really?
That helps if you grab somebody and say, here, hold this airway, or, you know,
That's something like that.
Is that a blue tag for you guys?
Yeah.
That makes sense. And then what's your bystander tag? White?
No, it's orange.
Orange, nice. Oh, that makes them stand out.
Do you have a bag for nurses who say they're nurses, but you really want them to go away? Or
no, yeah, but we have.
They carry zip ties for them.
it's the CNA who identifies herself as a nurse and gets in your way. Yeah,
we have little notepads we give to everybody to carry in their pocket, and on the back, the cardboard sheet on the back of that thing is printed a letter to a physician on scene.
You have the right to go away, and if you impede it, we'll be used against you.
If you specialize in one of the following things, you can go: podiatry, dermatology.
It's now a good time to mention I used to be a nurse.
I would be happy.
It's now a good time to mention how proud of we are for your career choice.
No, you know that. Well, in the States, it's very common for someone to. Well, of course, not all nurses are created equal. But also, I found maybe this happens to you guys too. Somebody who's not even a nurse, they're a CNA, and they come up and identify themselves as a nurse. I get that a lot, and sometimes it's like. Truly recognized, like, I know her. She works at this and this. She ain't a nurse. And you call them out, they just disappear. I've been part of a lot of annoying MCIs where not many people heard. Maybe you guys can appreciate this. Two church buses full of kids and preteens collide in front of the Dallas Morning News building.
Oh, no. No.
Every one of them is a minor. We have to transport every one of them. There are over 20. We were working with the Dallas Morning News, and just an army of reporters come up. And I had my picture taken so many times. It was just ridiculous.
You're buying ice cream forever.
Yeah. The other one, and this was kind of spooky, because I just started. I'd been a paramedic for about, I don't know, 6 months or so. And this was pretty common in Texas. Every once in a while, you'd have an MCI out of one vehicle. And it's usually a pickup truck full of migrant workers that flips and they spray all over the road. And we had one of those, 10 or 12 patients, and it was in our district. We weren't really getting a lot of help from other districts, but we had a lot of people on the road, and it seemed like a lot of old-timers were on scene. And this was a private ambulance service, so we didn't have a lot of old-timers, but it was like a whole bunch of old-timers and me, and I was freaked out a little bit, but I was doing well, and I had my two in the back. I still remember this to this day. A supervisor came to the back of my ambulance and opened the doors and had an arm and said, kind of this grizzled thing, hey, this belonged to you. I said, nope. All right, then. They closed the door, moved on to the next one that belonged to one of Alan's patients. just threw it on the floor. This one's, I'm missing one. So, yeah, it was that kind of scene. It was bad.
Can I ask
you? Sure.
Hmm? Oh, I was going to say, out of every MCI debrief, what is the number one thing that comes out of them all?
Communication.
Communication.
Yeah, communication.
I couldn't talk to X.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
And why did you need to talk to the sanitation worker? Why? What was the point behind that? Yeah, I love that one. Yeah. Or why did they need to talk to us, which is really more important? I couldn't get a hold of those people. You were fine. Yeah, I those are the ones I love because you always know that that's going to be the number one finding in any report or any after-action report. Skip, has that been your experience this week?
Communication is always it. We've established a pattern now. We can predict that we are going to have one of these things reliably every 7 to 9 months. It's just been absolutely consistent for the last 5 years. One of our exciting developments is that in about 3 weeks, we're going to take delivery of a multi-patient ambulance bus.
Oh.
purchased for us by our state emergency management agency to be a deployable resource in the state. But it will carry 14 patients in onboard beds and have mounts for several Stryker cots or the ability to tie down wheelchairs and other mobility assist devices.
Who designed and made this animal?
The company's called Sartan, and it was, this is sort of the second generation in North Carolina. The folks at Medic EMS in Mecklenburg County had the first generation, and we took on what they had built and made some refinements. And now there's, I think there's four different cities in North Carolina that are going to get buses of this configuration.
Oh,
we could do with one of them and deal with all the drunks at Leicester Square in a few weeks. I
mean, you know, it has the potential for many uses, and I'm thinking after some of the public festivals and rock concerts and stuff like that, you know, again, also because of the heat we deal with, we'll be able to use it for another source of air-conditioned inside rehabilitation.
Oh, yeah. But our sort of 11 concert, I can use that thing.
Yeah, really. our sort of paradigm, the one that keeps cropping up, is evacuating a nursing home. We've done three of those in the last 5 years. I'd rather not do any more of them, but they're uniquely challenging events, both because of communication issues and because of the mobility issues and the debilitation of most of the people you have to deal with.
Let me ask you, Skip, is there a national list of how many of these things exist for a national call list as well? Because I know in Houston they would have been begging for these things, you know, a couple of times in Katrina situations and that kind of thing.
And, you know, I think this is evolving. They're all, of course, you know, they can be called up through EMAC activation or by FEMA or whatever. But we don't have Aaron with us tonight, but I know that the demo model that was on display by Sartan at the at EMS Today in Baltimore, left Baltimore and went up to the Fargo, North Dakota area when they were having their flooding issues and had to evacuate a whole bunch of facilities. So people certainly know who they are or where they are, and the touch point is probably state emergency management agencies and however you get to them.
And Skip, how do you spell that?
The manufacturer?
Yeah.
Sartan, Sartan.
Oh, just like it sounds. Just like an old Sartan. Okay. So
they're located in High Point, North Carolina.
Oh, I'm looking to put it on the in the show notes, but what did something like that run?
You know, in the low 200,000.
Oh, God.
Wow. You know, I deign to say again, we didn't buy it with our budget. This was provided for us out of, I believe, Homeland Security funding by our state emergency management agency, combined with our state EMS office.
Yeah, but that's the price of two trucks, man. That's a deal.
I was just going to say, well, yeah, that's not too bad. Yeah.
But and you know, again, thinking what they're really bought for in our big mass casualty hazard in North Carolina is hurricanes. We're the third most impacted hurricane state after Florida and Texas. And the area that gets hit by hurricanes is fairly populous. So the state's been building capacity to be able to evacuate those areas in anticipation of the storm. And, you know, you can move 14 patients in ambulances also, but it takes two medics in a truck to do it. Most of these patients are subacute. They do not require constant individualized attention. So perhaps with four medics, or a medic and a couple of nurses, you can move 14, 16, 18 patients and conserve your ambulance assets.
Gee, Ben, you would have really, this would have really come in handy when you guys were doing a lot of skier transports between, I don't know, say, a really busy ski area and, I don't know, Denver, where you could just tell all the clinics, all right, we know you're going to call us every day between 3 and 4 o'clock. So you all call us, we're going to schedule it, we're going to come by, and we're going to pick up your patients and head them down. This is a great idea.
Just set up like a bus route.
Exactly. Well, that, and you could basically have the drum of morphine already in there, and you just program everybody for their own morphine on the way down, and you're just set. You just sit there and write reports, and everybody's happy. Man, now there's a plan. No, I love that. I 14 patients, so that's great. Although, you know, we're running short of time already because, man, this has been a great topic. We're at 35 minutes. But so what I really want to get to, too, is talk to Tom about this issue in the UK. What's going on with the blockers over there?
Yeah.
What's going on with you guys? What did you guys do? What happened? Give us the story. What happened?
Hey, it's not my fault. Okay, so... over here, we've got a couple of police bloggers, and they're all pretty much anonymous, in part because basically the police over here and bloggers don't hugely get on well because, well, they tell the truth, which is very different to what the police service would have you believe. So there was this anonymous blogger called Nightjack, and he won a prize, the Orwell Prize. And he blogged about the police and was really a very good blogger. Unfortunately, one of our newspapers, The Times, as we like to call it now, Chip Rappers, they seeked him out and they worked out who he was. And Nightjack, this blogger, then went to the courts and said, look, please... you know, have an injunction to stop them from publishing my name. And the courts went, okay, no problem. The Times then went to a higher court, and the judge turned around and went, no, you've got no expectation of privacy. If you're blogging, it's a public thing. Your identity should be public. Otherwise, how do people know you're really a police officer? So he's
screwed.
Yeah. To be fair, his police service, his county would be with you guys.
Like a sheriff, sheriff's deputy.
Yeah. Gave him a written warning and that was it. So they've handled it quite lightly. But obviously he's now stopped blogging. He's had to delete all his archives. And what's bad about it is other police bloggers are now stopping because they've just seen exactly how dangerous it is. And you know, they've got mortgages to pay, they've got kids to feed, and suddenly, you know, this anonymity which you thought was protecting you so you could tell the truth about what was going on no longer exists.
Mm. Do we know what happened to him job-wise?
Yeah, he's...
He got a written warning, and that was it?
Written warning, that was it. He's still in his job.
That's not bad, considering.
Exactly. I mean, people have lost their jobs before. The thing is, this isn't the first time that The Times has outed bloggers. A friend of mine is a sex blogger, and they outed her. And
what was the point of that?
It's their argument... and this is a really poor argument, is that it's in the public interest, which is a load of rubbish, to be honest. It's not in the public interest. To prove that you have sex or to prove that you're a police officer, you know, people reading the blog understand it, you know. And anyway, it's a blog and people will take it with a pinch of salt if certain things don't ring true. But... it's very frightening because who's going to want to risk basically their career, their mortgage, their family on a blog? You know, it's very easy to turn and say, well, it's just not worth it.
Mm. And what was their argument for doing this? I mean, you said they thought it was in the public good for people to know who this was.
The full-time, the commercial media hate blogging.
I was just going to say that.
Because it is a free threat to their, you know, their subscription-based business.
Sure.
You know, yeah. They hate them. So if they can, as a matter of policy, disrupt, discredit, or destroy bloggers on subjects that are of interest to the public at large, hey, they got lawyers on standby ready to play the game.
Yeah, I was looking for the angle on this because there's got to be one. There's no reason why you would go out of your way to do this unless you had an angle. And that's just kind of disturbing.
It's very worrying. You're absolutely right. It's because the newspapers, specifically the Times, I mean, the talk is that they're now going to put all the Times online stuff behind a paywall.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to work well.
No. The newspapers over here are failing. They're dropping like flies. Mm. And a lot of that is from Craigslist and other things that may not be in your area. Is the Times in as much financial trouble as some of these U.S.-based papers?
Yeah, I mean, it's basically the collapse of the advertising market in the recession.
Oh, okay.
And talking to some journalist friends of mine, they're all very, very worried. They're all really starting to panic. Mm. And it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, in the space of next year or two, we see some big name newspapers go bankrupt.
Yeah,
we've already seen that over here.
We've seen already in the U.S.
There's a ton of newspapers going bankrupt.
Yeah.
Well, and I think we hit the nail on the head that old media can't handle new media, and that's really, I mean, that's the show. The old media, yeah. EMS, magazine, Gems, don't understand what I'm doing. And I'm just bringing news to people. We're talking about issues, and they can choose to listen or not. But it's a way to be more interactive. And I don't, the companies that get it and understand it are moving ahead, and they're going to be fruitful, and they're going to be able to do well. But man, the old media is not going to be able to stand it much longer. And apparently there's no such thing as freedom of press over there, or freedom of speech in the UK. So, because that would never fly in the United States.
Well, there more or less is, but you know, I'm not sure the U.S. courts would do anything differently with that.
You don't think?
The common law of the United States and the UK are pretty well joined at the hip on an awful lot of issues. And we talk about a right of privacy as though such a thing actually exists in law, and it does not.
Yeah, you have the right to free speech, but if you put your name down, you can say anything you want. You
that's
know?
Right. You do not have the right to be free of the consequences of your speech.
No. I think the difference between the UK and America is we don't have a written constitution. It's just this aggregation of sort of thoughts and social mores that have just sort of like bimbled along and just got us to where we are now.
Going back to the Magna Carta too, or something.
Oh yeah, oh yeah. I think you know the U.S. Constitution basically took two things. One is the things that folks in America wanted, but they weren't entitled to under English common law, and the things that they were entitled to under English common law, and they put them in a document and say, we want to keep all of this. Mm. But when you talk about how courts will take apart and come down on a particular issue like this, I wouldn't be surprised, given the right case, we got it exactly to the same answer.
This is kind of interesting to me because so many authors write under a pseudonym, and there are some whistleblower laws, and
yeah.
I don't know. this is interesting because I maybe I'm wrong, but I don't remember in recent memory anyway anybody coming after an author who's using a pseudonym. And I'm just wondering why. Well, I know why now, but you know, I guess because authors are not a threat to the newspaper, basically.
Right.
It is.
Yeah.
Can I real quick, Tom? Do I understand it correctly in this that basically what the court decision said was that it was okay that the Times of London had released his name?
Yeah. Basically, Knightjacks wanted an injunction to prevent the Times from publishing his name.
Okay. So they didn't force any internet companies to turn over records or things like that publicly identified him. So there's still, I mean, it sounds like there's still hopefully at least an opportunity to remain anonymous, but people who are going to blog about this stuff, I think, should understand that if you want to be anonymous online, you need to, it sounds like, take the steps to do so.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of cutting out the people who aren't hugely technically minded.
Yeah.
And it's cutting them out from it because they don't necessarily know how to be anonymous.
And the other thing to keep in mind with this is not a case about protection from the government.
No.
Government was not outing the blogger. The newspaper was outing the blogger. So this is the case of the government declining to protect one civilian interest from another civilian interest.
Yeah.
Well, can I... what is the problem? I mean, really, okay, so I'm blogging and my name's out there. I mean, if that's your opinion, shouldn't you be allowed to say it?
Now you got to go outside an organization of 12 people, you know, and the police services, as I understand them in the UK, are regional in nature. And they're good sized organizations, like the Chicago Police Department or the Philadelphia Police Department or something, with a hierarchy and what have you. And if what you're blogging about is sort of the dark side of the organization's secrets, and you're the guy who's talking about him and exposing him to the public, not only may your bosses be mad about you and give you, you know, adverse job actions, but some of your colleagues may take offense in a far more exciting form.
Oh, very good point.
Yeah, and I can see that. I've kind of abandoned all pretense of anonymity online, and my name's up on pre-hospital blog. I'm kind of, you know, this is who I am. And I think I would understand if my employer got upset if I talked about something that they considered sensitive or, you know, anything like that.
I will tell you, I'm pretty active on, you know, the forums at gems.com and what have you. And I have never liked anonymity or hiding behind screen names, but that causes me to pick my words carefully sometimes.
Absolutely.
I mean, look at it from the other side. You've got newspapers and you've got journalists who sometimes even go to prison to protect their sources, to avoid naming them. And ironically enough, about two or three days after this story broke, there was a journalist who was refusing to give over the name of a suspected terrorist. And she was allowed to, you know, she wasn't forced to give over that name. So it very much is one rule for one, another rule for others. And it just seems like, well, they're bloggers, they can't afford proper lawyers, so we can dominate them.
Am I right in thinking that there's maybe two different classes of bloggers? There's the, call it your high-end bloggers, that consider it a journalistic profession and even are crying out and want to be treated like journalists. And then there's probably the rest of the bloggers, probably the 90% of the bloggers who are just kind of writing for fun, would rather most people don't know that this is them and just kind of happy with it that way.
Yeah. I think that's a reasonable sort of idea.
Does the Electronic Frontier Foundation have any sort of presence in the UK or in Europe, or is that just us over here?
we have, and I am a proud member of the Open Rights Group, which is kind of like the UK EFF. In fact, it was formed in answer to the question of where is the English, well, the UK EFF. And I don't think we're as quite as powerful as the EFF. And we tend more towards giving information to consultation documents, like the recent one which was released about how to make Britain a more digital nation. But to be honest, I think Nightjack just wants to put it all behind him and get back to just doing his job. And I honestly can't blame him if that's what he thinks.
Well, I think it's important, maybe it's an important lesson for us all to learn that a couple of things. One, anything you say online is there forever. It will be there. I mean, even the things he said will still be there. It'll be cached somewhere. It'll be held somewhere. It'll always be there. And it's just like you as an author, Tom. You write something in a book, and it's there. And it's there for people to refer back to. They know about it, and they're gonna be able to find it. So if you're willing to write it down and you're willing to say it, you better be willing to stand behind it, and you better be willing to. Just be ready to answer for it, even if you, I mean, if it was a little outlandish or whatever. You
did anybody see the article out of Bozeman, Montana last week?
No.
It was fascinating. Do you guys know who Gordon Graham is?
No.
Gordon is a well-known speaker on the public safety circuit. He's an attorney who retired as a captain in the California Highway Patrol. And he's their director. He was their director of risk management. And a fascinating speaker. But I was communicating with him about background checks for prospective employees, and he sent me a link to an article out of Bozeman, Montana, where the city had adopted as part of its job application process.
Oh yeah,
give us your Facebook and MySpace account information.
That's right.
Oh yeah.
So they wanted passwords. I've heard.
They wanted to be able to go in and see what, you know, examine your character by way of your Facebook account or MySpace page.
Yeah.
And it's
because
quite
too lazy at Google. it's too lazy at Google.
I read yesterday or the day before though that they had thank God caved and took off that requirement.
Yeah,
I think the moral of the story, though, is, and somebody put it very succinctly, these on the, you know, social networks and blogs and stuff, they're like a tattoo.
Sure.
Once you get them, they're very hard to get rid of.
Well, the Obama administration had mandated that basically everybody wanted to be a part of the administration, you know, all the advisors and everything. Give up everything. Now, I don't know, you know, and I think about my online life. I was like, well, what do you want me to do? Give you the name of every word board that I dialed up on a phone modem in the 80s on my Amiga 500? You know, I mean, it would be a ridiculous request that I could never, ever comply to. And I'm just wondering, because seriously, some people had to turn over 15 years of, oh yeah, I posted on this thing and I was part of this message board. And apparently some people's submissions got up to 800 or 1,000 pages. And I think it's just too much. It's crazy.
I think some of that, you know, more executive government level stuff, though, is somewhere where maybe you start to expect that kind of scrutiny, too.
Mm. Yeah, but I mean, okay, so if we're going to expect this kind of scrutiny, in what's the form by which we should be keeping this data? I mean, because really something that complicated is much larger than a resume or a CV. I mean, what are we supposed to do? I just think it's a ridiculous request, for one. I mean, get on a search engine, go look for me if you want to. I would think that, okay, if I'm going to apply for a government position and I've owned domain names and I've been a blogger before, okay, maybe you want to see that stuff. But to ask me for every email address I've ever owned or every message board I've ever posted, come on. That's impossible.
So you're saying you don't have every computer you used to own? up in your loft. and you can just pull them all down and start searching those 40 megabyte hard disk drives.
Yeah, the first.
Oh, I've still got some 8.5-inch floppy disks lying around.
Oh.
Anybody who wants to is welcome to search.
Yeah, the first place I posted online, actually, you needed to actually rotary dial the phone and then stuff it into the two.
Yeah,
that was
happy days.
It was a 300 baud modem. So come on, search that.
They called that Morse code, I think.
Yeah, yeah. That's ridiculous.
Well,
I mean, part of the problem is these things are only fairly new, and we're still finding our way through them. You know, we're still trying to learn what's acceptable and what's not.
Well, I think the other important. The other important point of this, too, we're all talking over each other, sorry about that. The other important point to think about, too, in this whole argument is that the law is very slow in catching up with technology, and this is just another way that... And I think the EFF has really done its due diligence to really get out there, at least in America for sure, to make sure that anything like this doesn't really start hampering the issues that cloud the and blur the lines of technology and law, and boy, I know that there's so much on this subject that we could just dive into. But Tom, are you going to continue to blog then?
Oh yeah, well my bosses know I am.
Oh, okay.
Well, you've been on TV too. They at least have your mug.
I was going to say they know who you are.
Yeah. I met my boss for the second time. The first time was over a dead heroin addict. And the officer who was driving him around pulled him away from me very quickly. But I met him for the first proper time a couple of days ago, and he has a little blog. It's all internal, but he has his blog, and I'm kind of hopeful that he can see that those of us who are blogging, for the ambulance service, we've got a couple. We're the people who are evangelical about our jobs. We love our jobs. We love the service. We love doing our jobs. Because that's why we come home at the end of a 12-hour shift, and instead of cracking open a beer and watching some telly, we knuckle down and write about it. We are these people who love it. Or just love to moan about it. But, you know, it's the same sort of thing.
That's the alternate track for anybody out there who is blogging. Maybe involve your management at work. Let them know, hey, I'm blogging over here. This is what I'm doing. You guys should follow it and watch it. And, you know, if you read something that you don't like, let me know. I'll let you have your say or, you know, help maybe even engage your employer in that process.
I mean,
if they're receptive to it.
Well, hey, this is all pretty serious. But is anybody happy that the governor of South Carolina returned? has that made national news yet?
Just today.
Yeah, you know. Okay, whatever. You know, I mean, I'm just like, can we just get off the getting into people's, you know, underneath their bedroom and every in between their sheets and just let people live? Jeez, drives me nuts. Ugh. But you know, it's sensational journalism, and yeah, I am pretty sure he came out about it because it was going to get found out, and he just knew that it was. I applaud the guy. At least he came up and he was up front and he said, "Hey, here's what I did. Screwed up. Sorry. Whatever." So, I know I actually wanted to ask you about that tonight, Skip, but I thought, well, we'll let it go. Well, you know, we. I don't know if I just lost everybody or if it just got really quiet because I was just rambling on. I do want to give everybody a chance here at the end to say a couple words about what you're doing, what's next, and Tom, where are you going? I cannot find a link for that show anywhere on the internet. So you're gonna have to send me we want to see you on TV in the UK. So send us that link so we can see it.
It will be YouTubed. It will be YouTubed once I can be bothered to upload it.
Very nice. So we're getting really bad feedback from you. I'm not sure if it's the tubes between here and the UK or what, but thanks for joining us, Tom. And where can we find you on... What is your blog address?
randomreality.blogware.com. If you just Google for LIS blogger, you'll find me.
And that's randomreality.com. Yeah.
Blogware.com.
Okay. Sorry, Tom, you're really breaking out. I don't know what's going on there. Skip, how about you?
Oh, I'll probably go to a debriefing. getting ready for the things that usually happen in the summer that not necessarily that we enjoy. We will, if past summers hold true, we will advance to roughly one recreational drowning per week here for the next 3 months. Many of them pediatric, and of course that's very stressful on personnel. And we will probably quadruple.
And we just lost Skip. Wow. I don't know. Everything's falling apart. He said it will quadruple something, but you can also follow Skip.
Kind of like a horror movie, right?
I know. he's just completely lost. You can also follow Skip on Jim's Connect, and you can find him at EMS United. Ben, how about you? Prehospitalblog.com? Is that right?
Oh, I'm all over the place. Yeah, prehospitalblog.com works. Synchronous with tonight, I'm got a post coming on lessons learned as the medical unit leader for modal MCI exercise we just recently did. So stay tuned for that. And
nice and timely, I tell you. That's good.
Yeah.
Hey, Skip, welcome back. You said quadruple something.
Hey. The number of incidents that we provide rehabilitation support to, even the smallest of structure fires in the summertime here require some pretty heavy hands-on at-scene rehabilitation. So we'll be filling the ice coolers every morning and stocking the units to be able to do that. So it's summertime.
Very nice. Well, we keep losing. Hey, Buck. What about you? Tell us. We've already given you a plug for copycode3.com.
In the Carolinas.
Oh, okay. And he's back. That's weird. He's back. Hey, Buck. What about you?
Oh, you know, as somebody's hearing this, the other show will be probably available as always. Every Thursday we do the MS Educast. And so it's probably up if you're listening to this. And go check it out. We're doing everything FISDAP this week. And talking about tracking and charting and studying skills competencies in the field and whatnot. We're going to have a good time with that. Got a whole bunch of cool guests lined up for that. You can also catch me on Twitter at Buckman and catch me on my little blog at Gomerville.com. I finally put something new up. So if you want to find out why I'm mad at the AHA this week, go there and read what I put up there. And I'm really mad at the AHA. I'm mad at people who try to take AHA classes.
Aren't you mad at the AHA every week?
No, not really. Not really. They got to make a living. So do I.
I thought that was just your standing of... Okay, anyway, I'm sorry.
I'm mad at everybody.
Maybe you should be our curmudgeon. Ever since I called Keith Wesley that, he hasn't come back on. I shouldn't have called him that. But hey, I'm just saying what people were saying. Not me. Not me by any...
Don't shoot the messenger.
Well, I'm Chris Monteri, your host. Hey, what was that? Go ahead. Oh, somebody was saying something. All right. I'm Chris Monteri, your host. You can find me, Geeky Medic, on everything. So just find me, Geeky Medic, on Facebook, on, I can't remember, Twitter, and all those other shows. Join us, emsleadership.com, emsleadership.com, emsgarage.com, and emseducast.com, and very soon, emsgeek.net. So that's coming up very soon. I know Ben's working on that, and we'll be having that show out probably sometime mid-July. Might even debut around the same time as Buck. So that'll be a fun show, and one more show is in the works. So we have – that'll be – I don't know the domain name yet, so I can't really have anybody go there. But we're coming, and we've got you. So thank you guys for joining us, and thanks for listening to the EMS Garage. And please join us next week so you can listen to me ramble and – stumble over my words right at the end and listen right at the end of this podcast because there's something really cool. So again, thanks for listening to the EMS Garage.
and he gets home. He climbs up onto his bunk bed, and then his feet start to go numb, and then his legs start to go numb, and it starts creeping up his body. And I'm thinking, hold up, that's a special French name disease.
Guillain-Barré?
That's the one.
Wow.
And, yeah, there was no...
I really don't know anything about things like that, except I thought I had it once.
See, I know about it. Pronouncing it is a completely different matter. And, yeah, so we had to get the scoop under him. And, right, so I'm 6'1". I'm old. My trousers are too tight. I've got size 12 boots. I've got bad back. And there I am, crunched over in about 3 foot of clearance space, bouncing around on his kid's bed. My crewmate, she is 5'6". She does pole dancing for exercise. She is mighty, mighty limber. And she's standing there watching me.
What's wrong with that picture, huh?
It's only as we're coming back from the hospital after dropping the kid off, I think, hold up a minute. See, I'm smart, but I'm not that quick.